This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The first round of spring drug testing among baseball players turned up over 40 positives this week, almost all of them at the minor league level. In fact, so far the only positive result in the major leagues belonged to Alex Sanchez of the Tampa Bay Devil Rays. Joining me now to discuss what the first results mean and portend is John Levesque, a columnist for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. John, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. Nice to be with you.
Of the 40-plus minor leaguers who have so far tested positive, 8 are affiliated with the Seattle Mariners. That is the highest number of any team. Is there any rational explanation for this?
Well, I'm not sure there's rational explanation, but you have to cheer the fact that the Mariners will be leading the league in something this year. So beyond that, it may be early for rational explanation, only because when you look at the release of the drug tests in the minor leagues, what was announced this week is only a partial list. It was mainly teams that train in Arizona and the teams that train in Florida. That list is yet to come, I guess, sometime next week. But in terms of looking specifically at the Mariners, and I guess what you're asking, why this team has more than others, my only suggestion in a column yesterday was that maybe the Mariners are signing dumber players. In this day and age, with minor league testing now 5 years old, it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense that there would be that many players testing positive, and you'll hear the players saying, well, it was only a supplement I was taking, and apparently there's something in that supplement that I didn't know about. Well, my sources tell me that's not the case. Maybe there are one or two of those, but from what they learned from the testing agency, these people were taking steroids, whether it's orally or injectably. They were not doing what they were supposed to be doing.
I'm not sure I've ever before read about how many minor league players have tested positive for steroids or for other drugs. Were this spring's numbers high, average, low, what?
I can't answer that specifically either because the numbers weren't released, even though the testing has been in place for several years. They weren't releasing names and affiliations until this year. The reason Bud Selig, the commissioner of baseball, decided to do it this year was to just make it consistent with the new plan in place at the major league level. He figured that, well, if we're going to humiliate the major leaguers, we might as well humiliate the minor leaguers as well.
Teach them how to take humiliation at a low level.
Exactly. Start them early.
Do you think Bud Selig and the rest of the people who run baseball regard the fact that only one major leaguer has tested positive as evidence that the current system of testing and sanctions is working?
Well, they're certainly going to tell you that, and the general managers I talk to actually believe in the system, but I think at the team level, they don't think that it's working just yet. It'll take a while. The fact that only one person was discovered probably indicates that the players have learned to stop soon enough before the testing begins. What often happens is they'll take these supplements or whatever they feel they need to get stronger and to recover more quickly. They take these during the winter before spring training. And so what major leagues need to do and what the new testing policy says is now possible, they can test whenever, wherever. And so the players are now learning, well, we can't do this anymore. We can't do something in the wintertime and then stop. And so I think throughout the season, I'd be very surprised to see that many more because I think the players at the major league level, the players have finally gotten the message that this is silly. I don't want my name out there, whether it's perceived to be accidental or not. I don't want to be associated with something that is now perceived as cheating.
Well, they may also feel, gee, I felt I had to do this to compete in the past, but now maybe everybody's going to be stopping. It'll be a more even playing field, and I don't have to do it.
Well, I'm not sure that the playing field is ever perceived to be level because it's such a fine line between being the last guy to make the team and the guy in the minor league system who is just that close to making the major league team. The pull of doing something to just get 1 ounce of strength that'll bring them to the major league level is inexorable, that they feel they need to do something beyond their own capabilities, and so they resort to something artificial and now illegal.
As you said, the minor league tests included only players present in the Cactus League, the teams that practice in Arizona. The results for the Grapefruit League, which is larger, are not yet in. Do you expect a lot more minor league positives?
Well, I wouldn't say a lot more. There are a couple more, you know, teams, as you say, in training in Florida than in Arizona. And I don't think you can actually say it has much to do with one team's culture over another, because these players go back and forth. You can't say that the eight members of the Mariners organization all came up through the Mariners organization, and therefore there's something wrong within this organization. It's more actually the marginal players, the ones who think they need something extra to get to the major league level, who are doing this. If you're able to measure that desperation factor, I think you're better off than measuring, you know, culture within organizations.
John Levesque is a columnist for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Bill. Thanks.
Last spring, Only a Game ran a series of audio diaries by Adam Hizdu, who had tried and failed for the previous 12 seasons to make a Major League opening day roster. Though he failed a 13th time in 2004, Hizdu did get the call-up from the Red Sox, and he will receive a World Series ring for his brief stint in Boston. The 33-year-old outfielder and his wife Julie decided baseball and radio diaries were both worth another shot this spring.
We can't believe we're going back again, that we're, you know, uprooting again, we're moving across the country, but this is our vocation and that's what we're going to do.
My name is Julie, and we've been married 13 years. We met when we were 16, so we're high school sweethearts, and we've moved about 54 times. So we think every year it's going to get easier, and it doesn't. With three children, it's getting harder, and they really don't know any different. They know this is what their daddy does for a living, so we just pack up and go.
It's been like the last 6 years. It just seems like she's like, okay, you still like baseball? You still love it, right? Yes. Okay, let's go.
You know, if baseball ends tomorrow, I will be totally fine with that. If we go another 5 years, we'll go another 5 years. I'm going to do what it takes. This is his passion. This is his job. This is how he provides for our family. And yes, the money would be better in the major leagues, but that's not what it's about. This is what he loves to do, and there's always hope.
Well, we're in Florida. I'm in Florida. Lonesome Dove riding solo. Played the Cardinals today. Went to left field for Manny, and then center field. My first at-bat, I hit a 3-run home run against the Cardinals. This was about as good as I can hit a baseball. And then an inning later, I make maybe the best play I've ever made in the outfield. You know, line drive in the gap, I'm on a full sprint. Bases loaded with two outs, and it's a 3-run game. So if I don't catch it, then the game's tied. Leap with some elevation, get perfectly horizontal to the ground, and make a catch. It was kind of a cool thing. Bam. I've just been traded. If it's a better opportunity, I'll just have to wait and see. San Diego's West Coast, that's a 5-hour drive, 4.5-hour drive from my house. All in all, spring training has, you get sized for a World Series ring, you meet the President of the United States, you get traded, and it is a spring training for the ages.
While we're packing again, leaving a team that you know, in relationships and already having housing planned and kids' sports kind of planned, and I had dentist appointments planned the next day, and here we are back in Arizona within the day. So it's very interesting, but you know, for us it's nothing new. We're in the waiting game again, wondering if he's going to make the team. He seems like he's got to prove himself all over again.
San Diego, California. What a beautiful town. I'm in San Diego. Of course, no word yet if I've made the team or not. It's Friday night, April Fool's Day, and I oftentimes feel like a fool. I mean, because I'm just, I don't know, it's just every year I got to explain to people, you know, well, what's going to happen? I don't know. But
it really depends on their center fielder. If he is able to go, then I'll have to start in Portland, which is AAA, which is AAA. Which is AAA.
So we'll see come Monday whether I'm on the roster or not.
Since we don't know where he's going, we're just going to kind of stay in hotels. Right now, if he's on San Diego on opening day, we'll be there. we'll probably be at the Marriott and instead of a home. But if he goes to Portland, we'll kind of wait and see what the schedule is there and probably go up there. I'm not making any plans to move as of right now.
April 3rd, we traveled to Lake Elsinore, California, to play the Lake Elsinore Storm, the high A affiliate of the San Diego Padres. Anyway, at the end of the game, they pull me into the office and they say, you're going to join us in Colorado for opening day. I did it. I made the team. Julie and the family are going to come over for opening day, and we're going to enjoy it.
Oh, it was pure joy when he told me. Pure joy. There's a little bit of hesitation because, you know, it might only be for 15 days. We want to find a place to live in San Diego, yet I can't do it. So this will probably be another year of moving around.
Opening day is come and gone. We open in Colorado. The game today was a typical game at Coors Field. The final score was 12-10. I got into the game, double switch, played left field, had a chance to make a play of a lifetime to end the game. Dove and just came up a little short. And so they wound up winning. It's just the way it is. Anyway, I'm excited about it. Feeling more and more part of the team. And looking forward to the rest of the season.
The Padres play the Pittsburgh Pirates, with whom Heisdew first broke into the majors, this evening in San Diego.
You gotta know how to catch. You gotta know how to throw. That's why I'm here in right field, just watching.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. Lads who've seen a jail sentence in Sweden as an opportunity to get bigger and stronger were bitterly disappointed recently when authorities there decreased the hours of prison gyms. About 1,000 prisoners in 20 institutions expressed their disappointment by staging a strike on Monday, refusing to attend any workshops or study sessions. The protest, which was nonviolent, has so far had no effect on institutional policy. We want to offer them other ways to keep fit, explained Swedish jail system security chief Christer Isaacson. We don't feel it is part of the mission that society has given us to create oversized muscle builders. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a much-ridiculed Canadian import lands in the nation's capital, and the fans are seeing red. But first, the previous embodiment of baseball in Washington never finished higher than fifth place in its 11-year struggle from 1961 to 1971. Those Senators finished 10th three times and 9th twice. Joining me now from New York to further explore the mostly bleak history of baseball in Washington, D.C., are the authors of Total Ball Clubs, The Ultimate Book of Baseball Teams, Donald Dewey and Nicholas Acocella. Gentlemen, welcome back to Only a Game.
And how are you, Bill?
And thank you, Bill.
Very well. One has to wonder if the name Washington Nationals was a good choice for the current team. The first Washington Nationals didn't even make it through their first season. What happened?
No, they didn't. In 1884, Washington had two teams, one in the more established league, the American Association, the other in an upstart league called the Union Association, and both teams, quite frankly, were dismal. The Union Association folded, but the Washington team in the league folded before the season was out and moved to Richmond, Virginia.
And that team characterized itself by employing a catcher who allowed 12 passed balls in one seven-inning game.
Yes, still the world's record. We suspect the guy was throwing knuckleballs, though.
Now, two teams later, along came the Washington Statesmen, and that club finished 44-91 and employed four different managers in the 1 year of its existence. How many of those guys quit, and how many were fired?
Oh, they were all fired. They were all fired. Washington, as you said, a very, very dismal history, and these early teams were... Let me back up a minute. This new Washington team will be the eighth Washington franchise, which is more than any other city. They just broke a seven-way, a tie of seven with a couple of other cities. It's just never been anything more than a second-rate baseball city.
There is, I think there is some solid reason for that. Washington is a city of not just like New York where people come to work, but people who come to work with an expiration date. If they work in the government, for instance, they know they're going to be there for 4 years or 8 years, so that they're always willing to go to games when, like, their hometown shows up.
Mm-hmm.
But you never had that cumulative crowd over the entire season. A second reason is because of the black population in Washington. There was never an attempt to encourage black fans to come to the ball game.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly before 1947, it wasn't even discussed. And in fact, when Clark Griffith, when his son Calvin, the Washington senators that we all know, the Harmon Killebrew senators, he had an offer to build a new ballpark in Washington. But they said, okay, but you build it in the black neighborhood. Well, that's the last thing he wanted to hear. So that's why they ended up as the Minnesota Twins. But I think those are the two essential reasons.
The addition of the senators that you've just mentioned, the Harmon Killebrew senators, mm-hmm. They were about as dismal as most of the other additions of Washington teams. However, it is fair to say that that franchise may have employed the guy who was the greatest pitcher of all time.
Oh, true. And they had some sterling years. I mean, they were certainly not as bad as any of the 19th century teams, and certainly and probably not as bad over the long haul as the successor Senators. But yeah, I mean, Walter Johnson may very well have been the greatest pitcher of all time and ended up with a team that took them, 20 years to get to the World Series.
Right. And I wanted to just mention my favorite fact about Walter Johnson's employment with the Senators. I love that management tried to cut his salary after a year in which he had won 28 games.
Well, sure, it was a bad year for him. I mean, he'd won 30-something the year before.
36 and, the year before, and they said,
so,
you don't deserve as much now.
Of course. I mean, I think that's fair.
The cloud that franchise in particular always operated under, and even more so since they left, was that famous phrase, first in war, first in peace, and last in the American League. But mm-hmm. as a matter of fact, they were not the only ones who had a slogan like that attached to them. The St. Louis Browns, who were, in fact, statistically worse. They were always branded with the label first in shoes, first in booze, and last in the American League, which to me was always much funnier.
Much funnier. And
funnier to
them,
me, too.
And it took them 44 years to get, or 41 years to get to a World Series.
Right.
So the Senators really had some highlight moments in the 20s and early 30s.
Well, that Washington team, as you mentioned, it had some highlights. It did actually win a World Series, but
mm-hmm.
from your account of that event, the win seemed to require, if not exactly divine intervention, at least some exceptionally unlikely bounces.
Two of them, as a matter of fact. One to tie the game, ball bounced over the third baseman's head, and one to win the game, bouncing over the same third baseman's head. I've always believed it was the same pebble.
The third baseman wasn't smart enough to kick it in the
He's been
the
looking for
territory.
A laugh for that line for years. He finally got it.
Well, he deserved it if he wasn't
thank
smart
you.
Enough to kick the pebble
you.
Over the bag.
That's exactly.
The longtime owner of that Washington franchise had a very odd answer, it seems to me, when somebody asked him whom he most admired in America.
The Lone Ranger.
The Lone Ranger. Io Silver.
Not only did he admire the Lone Ranger, that was the photo that he had, framed photo right on his desk. When people came to see Clark Griffith about, you know, can you give me another $300 for the next 5 years? Look at the Lone Ranger, son. There are American values.
That's American values, right.
What was the idea? He works for free?
Well, did you ever see the Lone Ranger being paid?
I never did. As far as I know, he never drew a paycheck.
There you go.
The Griffith family's version of the Senators relocated to Minnesota in 1960, at which point an expansion team, also known as the Washington Senators, appeared in town. Fourth place was such a triumph for that team that Ted Williams got named Manager of the Year for accomplishing that finish. Mm-hmm. And then in 1971, before becoming the Texas Rangers, those Senators lost the last game of their existence, and that was a hell of a story, too.
The last game in RFK Stadium of these soon-to-be Texas Rangers ended in a forfeit, which is, you know, a great ending for a team that was so bad, a franchise that was so bad. It's probably the only franchise that had better managers than players.
Well, the manager certainly could hit better than the players.
Well, not just Ted Williams. They also had Gil Hodges.
Right.
And they had the biggest batting hero in Washington for 50 years, Mickey Vernon.
Mickey Vernon, of course.
Those were, and
on the field, the only person that they could actually point to at all was Frank Howard, who would hit these titanic home runs. So you can't really find another franchise where the managers outdo the players
probably
3-1.
Could have outplayed the players, yeah. Probably. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you a final question. Are you happy that Washington has a team again? Because Major League Baseball certainly seems to be.
I think this is the culmination of, well, let's say it's at least the next to last chapter of probably the biggest industry fraud that's been going on in baseball
right.
for the last
right.
10 years.
Right.
This business about Montreal, about how, they didn't like baseball. Well, this was, in fact, the most successful, I would call it the most successful disinformation campaign conducted by baseball since Judge Landis was telling people we don't segregate. out and out lies about how the fans were not showing up because they were angry at the strike in 94, 95. I mean, we can go into detail about it, but the fact of the matter was, even during those worst years, let's say 96, Montreal's attendance was actually higher than 13 other teams, including the Mets and the Giants. In 1996 as well, the team went zooming up to second place. And so all of this has nothing to do with the fans just liking hockey. This we heard also in Pittsburgh, if you recall, in the 80s, they just like football.
Right.
The fact of the matter is that they wanted out of Montreal. It did not serve anymore from an industry point of view. And so Washington, to me at least, is just, as I said before, the next to last act of an absolute farce.
Well, for me, I wake up in the morning and the first thing I think is, what can I do that's in the best interest of baseball? And I don't think, I just don't think that Washington was in the best interest of baseball. I mean, it was the largest city without a franchise, but it's so close to Baltimore. I don't see how it works. And I don't see any local ownership emerging. And that's what has to be for a team to work.
Donald Dewey and Nicholas Acocella joined me from New York. They are the authors of Total Ball Clubs, the ultimate book of baseball teams published by Sport Classic Books. Guys, thank you very much for speaking with me.
And thank you. You're the best.
And a season's just a season. In a game that was supposed to be just a game, Walter Johnson cared about people more than he cared about fame. So all through baseball, he was loved and respected. Bitterness at Walter Johnson, well, it was never detected. Ooh.
The Washington Nationals, currently 2-2, will open at home against the Arizona Diamondbacks on Thursday. About 21,000 season tickets have been sold for this season, and the Nats' bright red home team caps are starting to look like standard-issue uniform on D.C.'s streets. Rachel McCarthy reports on why D.C. baseball fans have already embraced their new team.
Just back from watching the Nationals train in Florida, season ticket holder Donald Plavnik walks quietly into RFK Stadium and slips into a seat in section 309 to check out the view.
Can't see a fly ball anything higher than a bunt, but it's a good view of the field. On actual opening day, of course, you know, they're going to have the scoreboard up and the bullpens, and every seat's going to be filled. It'll be a lot more festive. Right now, you have to use your imagination watching all the construction work going on.
It's easy for the retired Marine to conjure images of batters up at the plate, even though on this day, RFK's field is still being converted from DC United's soccer pitch to the Nationals' diamond. That's because he still remembers the last time Major League Baseball was played in this stadium, on September 30th, 1971, when Plavnik solemnly watched his beloved Washington Senators' final game in D.C.
Well, it started out very placidly, like any mid-season game. There were only 14-plus thousand there, and it was quiet. But as the night went on, the emotions increased noticeably. And around 8th and 9th inning, fans began running onto the field in small groups and larger groups, and the players had to come and run for their lives, and everything that wasn't nailed down was stripped from the field. They finally turned the lights out to get the people out of the field.
The game was never finished, and the stadium lights at RFK eventually had to be turned off to get frustrated fans to leave. For supporters of D.C. baseball, that feeling of loss has continued through more than three decades of unfulfilled promises to bring baseball back to the city.
We almost had the Padres in 74. We almost had a team through Gerald Ford's intervention in 76.
Colin Mills grew up in Northern Virginia and is president of the Nats fan club.
We almost had an expansion team in 87 if they'd expanded, which they didn't. We almost had one of the 93 expansion teams. We almost had one of the 98 expansion teams. Disappointment has sort of become the lot of the Washington baseball fan, and so you just sort of come to appreciate that. It was kind of like Red Sox fans before this year. You just sort of come to expect in the end reality is going to find some way to come around and kick you in the teeth.
But even after all the disappointment, D.C. baseball fans didn't give up. They came to believe that not only did D.C. want a Major League Baseball team again, it deserved one.
After all the years and after all the embarrassing headlines, Murder Capital USA, Mayor Crackhead, and we've just been taking such a beating for such a long time, we're ready to show we are a living, breathing city. We're passionate. We care.
The D.C. area has changed a lot since the Senators left in 1971. It's gained 2 million residents, built a subway system, and shed its image as a city where everyone leaves after each presidential election. People say they're ready to be loyal fans. Again, Colin Mills.
We know how it was. We know what it was like to have a team, and we know what happens if you don't support your team. We know the price. So I think that there are too many people who have waited too long to let this opportunity slip by.
At a sports bar in downtown D.C., Devin Clancy takes a long lunch so he can watch a Nationals-Orioles spring training game. Devin didn't grow up in D.C. He's a diehard Red Sox fan. But he says he'll still enjoy being able to watch baseball, beer in hand, on lazy summer afternoons in his city.
It'd be great to be able to get on the metro and just go down to a game and walk over to the stadium and sit down. And there you got Major League Baseball right there. I mean, what more can you ask? I've lived here for 12 years without it, so I've had enough of that.
Back at RFK Stadium, Donald Plavnik confesses he won't truly believe baseball is back in the nation's capital until the first pitch is thrown.
Opening day here in Washington, that was a traditional presidential opener where the president would throw out the first ball. I've watched Presidents Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon all throw out the first ball. Hopefully we'll see President Bush here in a couple of weeks and each year after that. Well, you know, he owned the Rangers. You know, if he does too well, they might put him in on there, sign him to a contract.
A sold-out crowd of 46,000 people will be at the April 14th home opener against the Arizona Diamondbacks. For Only a Game, I'm Rachel McCarthy.
With Kennedy and Johnson, the way it ought to be. We'll be in Washington, D.C., dancing at the President's Jubilee. We're marching down to Washington, shake hands with John F. Kennedy. Marching down to Washington, the way they used to do.
You're listening to Only a Game. Brett Beeman of Columbus, Ohio, was unhappy with basketball writer Pat Forde's contribution to last week's program. He stated that Rick Pitino was the first coach to bring three teams to the Final Four, Mr. Beeman wrote. Wrong! C. Vivian Stringer brought the women's teams of Cheney, Iowa, and Rutgers to the Final Four. Don't have ignorant men talk about women's sports. Wally Firesteel, cowboy poet, emailed to say that he'd enjoyed my opening day poem on last week's program. I could not tear my ears away from the radio, he wrote. A troubling image, actually, but thank you, Mr. Firesteel. Following my conversation 2 weeks ago with 85-year-old skier Paul Shipper, who managed a string of over 3,900 consecutive daily appearances on the slopes of his local mountain, Chris Lowry, who hears Only a Game on New Hampshire Public Radio, wrote, "The story was unusual, great, but you left out a key point. Why did Mr. Shipper end his streak?" My apologies. On the day in January when his remarkable streak ended, Mr. Shipper had the flu. He has since recovered and he has skied again, although he said he wasn't in any hurry to begin a new streak. Once the smoke had cleared after the baseball segment of the congressional investigation into steroids in sports, David Summergrad, a WBUR listener, emailed as follows. Has anyone suggested punishing the teams instead of the individual players? What if, when a player tested positive, the team had to forfeit a certain number of games in which that player had appeared? This solution wouldn't need the permission of the union. Finally, Ray Simonic, who listens to the show online, emailed this week to say, what is Bill Littlefield laughing at so hysterically all the time? Is that laugh actually genuine? I can't believe it is, especially when he laughs at absolutely everything Charlie Pierce says. Charlie is very creative and engaging, but I've never even chuckled, much less laughed, at anything he said. See, Mr. Simonic, that's why you're not the host of Only a Game. The job description read, must laugh at pretty much everything Charlie Pierce says, and I've worked at it.
Thurlow Weed.
Your comments, questions, complaints, and humbugging will reach us at Only a Game, WBUR 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can reach us directly through our website, wbur.org, or you can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860.
Make them laugh, make them laugh, make them laugh.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by dairy farm families from Massachusetts and throughout New England who own Cabot Creamery, five generations making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, cabotcheese.com. And by Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, Bicon.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, the man who said no when Satchel Paige invited him on a barnstorming trip. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
As a sign of respect for Pope John Paul II, all soccer games in Italy were called off last Sunday. Various other sports had various other ways to commemorate the Pope's passing.
Yes, the Formula One team, the Ferrari Formula One team in Bahrain painted the nose cone of their red Ferraris black. Having been one of the last people that the late Pope saw in a Vatican audience. And in my hometown of Worcester, Massachusetts, the Pope was given the traditional boxing salute of having the bell ring 10 times in his memory, which I'm sure is the only thing the Pope had in common with, say, Salvador Sanchez. But better yet, the crowd was insufficiently respectful, and that noted keeper of papal traditions, Don King, made them quiet down and do it again.
At sports bookmaking establishments in Italy, a lot of gamblers have taken advantage of the opportunity to bet on who will become the next pope. What are the odds makers saying, Charlie?
Well, apparently Cardinal Tettamanzi is the winter book favorite to succeed John Paul II. But if you go a little bit deeper, particularly into the Irish website, which is taking books, and then you can also bet on the name that the next pope will
take.
Choose. Mm-hmm. John Paul apparently is the favorite there. John would be John Paul III. Sixtus is the long shot at something like 80 or 90 to 1. My favorite, Gelasius, which we haven't had in 600 or 800 years, isn't even on the board. I think they should get like a field bet for all the other names.
The galleries attending the first round of this week's Masters Tournament arrived expecting to see golf's best playing at the highest possible level, but instead ended up on a Keystone Kops set. Did Thursday's leader, Chris DeMarco, get it right when he said, quote, "Darn, it's golf."
It's golf. It's real golf. It's public league golf. Tiger Woods putted a ball into Rae's Creek. Billy Casper hit five shots in the water and took a 14. David Toms was standing over a putt on the 14th hole, and a wind gust blew it back out into the fairway, and Ernie Els spent most of the time in the jungle. I don't know about you, but this is the kind of golf I like to watch on TV. I like to see them struggling. I like to see them sweating. I like to see them grunting in anguish and anger. Basically, I like to see them be me.
You are just back from St. Louis and the Final Four. You can't possibly be as surprised at the men's result as everyone seems to be at the women's result.
Well, I think you saw this weekend a couple of stars being born. Sean May, whom everybody knew was good and who's finally, I think, blossomed into, if not the new Charles Barkley, one level below that. But Sophia Young of Baylor was just a revelation to everybody. She got 26 points. Baylor won, beat Michigan State easily. The first title ever for the Baylor Bears for a women's team. But Sophia Young is the next face of women's basketball.
The Los Angeles Lakers will not make the NBA playoffs and will post their first losing season in 11 years. Shaq won, Kobe nothing.
I believe that is the conclusion drawn. It's remarkable. You saw the same thing in Orlando when Shaq left there to go to Los Angeles, and people said, well, it's okay, he was the problem. It'll be Penny Hardaway's team now. He left L.A. to go to Miami. People said, it's okay, it was his problem. It'll be Kobe's team now. Guess what? It was Shaq's team there, it was Shaq's team in Orlando, and it's Shaq's team in Miami, even though Dwayne Wade, I have to admit, has had a fine year.
On Wednesday, the Philadelphia Phillies earned the distinction of the first team to lose to the Washington Nationals. Anything else in the first few days of Major League play strike you as noteworthy?
Not particularly. We had a very strange weekend in New York where the Red Sox and the Yankees proved once again that while the rest of the country may just be sick of them, they are uniquely matched to play terrific baseball games against each other. And on top of everything else, we had the very strange event surrounding Boston manager Terry Francona, whom we all hope is all right and apparently will be back for opening day, being unable to manage the team the last game in New York and the subsequent series in Toronto because of chest pains.
My own candidate for baseball story of the week comes from San Francisco, where L.A. Dodgers pitcher Eric Gagne was ejected from a game. Now, that's no big deal. It happens all the time. But there was a kind of a kicker here.
Yeah, he wasn't playing at the time. He was on the disabled list for a sprained right elbow ligament and not laryngitis, it turns out. And Gagne is not a small figure either. I mean, he's one of the baseball's greatest closers. He won the National League Cy Young Award a couple of years ago. But this is just very, very strange. I know the game is always ahead of the umpires in the early season, but people are being just a little touchy here.
We have a winner in the Congressional Steroid Testing Sweepstakes, Charlie, and that is Tampa Bay outfielder Alex Sanchez. Is Major League Baseball secretly relieved that it wasn't a high-profile player who got caught?
I think Major League Baseball is secretly throwing a parade that it wasn't a high-profile player caught. You know, he will lose $32,787, which is a considerable amount of money to the Alex Sanchez's of the world. At first, he was going to fight the suspension, and then he's decided he won't appeal it. It's 10 days. He'll be back. Baseball has its first trophy case.
You will be happy to learn, I'm sure, that the South Carolina doctor who apparently provided steroids to members of the Carolina Panthers is working on a book. Jose Canseco's business agent is Dr. Short's agent as well, so I can't see how this project can go wrong.
It's a shocking story on who's been using them and what doctors have been prescribing. He's going to name players who have been his patients. In other words, I did it, I made bigger football players, and now me some too, yes? I will cash in.
And finally, Mr. NASCAR, I give you the sponsor of the car driven by Kim Crosby. Do you think she'll take some heat for piloting the butt paste mobile?
Now, let's get it right. It's not just butt paste. It's Boudreaux's butt paste, yeah. It was developed by Louisiana pediatrician Pappy Talbot.
Of course it was.
And compounded by a local pharmacist named George Boudreaux in the town of Covington. It's a combination of ingredients, 16% zinc oxide, a proprietary blend of Peruvian balsam, boric acid, castor oil, mineral oil wax, in a wax and petroleum base. And
you've given away the formula.
And not only that, it's really butt paste. We're not kidding. This isn't like, you know, a schoolhouse glue invented by Dr. Houston Butt. This is applied to, keeping in the context of the item, the trunk of the human being.
The small derriere.
The extremely
of small
of the
people.
The extremely
who have
small
rash.
Of the back.
That's right. Okay. Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he applies the balm of logic and wisdom to a rash of sports issues each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
All the way through that item, and not one joke about rearview mirrors.
Satchel Paige, who claimed he once won three games in one day for the Kansas City Monarchs, may have been baseball's greatest pitcher. He was certainly one of the game's best talkers, and that quality is apparent throughout a new book entitled Satchel Paige's America. William Price Fox is the author of the book and the beneficiary of many hours of Satchel Paige's company over a stretch of days 30 years ago. William Price Fox joins me now from Charleston, South Carolina. Welcome to Only a Game.
Glad to be here.
You had your conversations with Satchel Paige back in the 70s. Why is the book coming out only now?
Well, that's a long and terrible story. I didn't know what I had, but I kept putting it off because I didn't know what it was. It could have been a stage play or a screenplay or a novel or what. And when you can't decide, the best thing to do is not decide. So I didn't decide. And then I discovered that the conversation itself was a good book because no one had ever done that. He didn't like doing interviews. He didn't like being taped. His voice went flat, and if you write his stuff down as he spoke, he kept looking at it and trying to make sure. You know, he never got relaxed. But with me, we started telling jokes and stories with no tape, and I recall most of them, and that's the way it worked. He had this great voice, and he had something that no one I've ever heard. Richard Pryor's got a little bit of it. They do that high-low voice, that real high, over-articulated voice.
Mm-hmm.
He'll say now, I say, how'd you pitch to Mickey Mantle? He says, I throw Mickey my hesitation pitch. He strike at it twice. And then I said, how about Ted Williams? He said, Williams? I said, yeah. He says, low, low and outside. Up in here, shame on you. So everything he said had that glide and that roll to it, and no one was picking that up. When I heard it, I knew I was home.
You had a number of meetings with Satchel Paige, as you say, most of them in bars and rib joints, some of them on ball fields. And mm-hmm. my understanding is that you made it clear from the outset that there was something in it for him if he was willing to tell you his stories. Is that right?
Well, I didn't put it on in so many words. I just said, you've been screwed so long by reporters. See, what the reporters were doing were making up stories about him mm-hmm. and then shading stuff. And reporters said he didn't eat anything fried. And God, he got so mad about that. He says, how am I going to eat my eggs and bacon and sausage in the morning if I can't fry it? He said, maybe they think I ate me some Wheaties with some berries on it. He just got real mad about that. But there's a lot of stories about him that weren't true at all. And that's one of them. And the reporters that came along after that just reworked it.
And once those stories were out there, they were going to be out there. There was no way that people weren't going to keep letting them grow.
Yes, they're still out there. And they're, you know, that, and that, it's nice that they kept going because it's kind of funny to see them out there. At the same time, it's nice to know about what happened.
Well, besides the kind of things that he mentioned about how to pitch to particularly mm-hmm. great hitters, Mickey Mantle or Ted Williams, what were some mm-hmm. of the favorite stories that you got to replace the stories that most of the rest of people who read newspapers and magazines assumed were true, their favorite Satchel Paige stories?
He ran whiskey for a while, and he also worked in the medicine show. He played Mr. Bones on the end, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He did a lot of things no one knew about. But his baseball was the main thing, and he had a lot of money, and then he'd blow it. He'd give it to all his friends and loan it out. And any old ball player coming to town would go right to Satchel's house, and Satchel would pay the cab fare and then loan him a couple hundred dollars. And he was great on his feet. We went to a nightclub one night called the Flamingo. The minute we walk in, the band stops playing, one of these big brass bands, you know, trombones, trumpets, the whole thing. The band stops, and the orchestra leader said, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Baseball himself, Leroy, Satchel Paige, give him a hand. So Satch gets in the middle of the dance floor and does a double spin, you know, around and around, and waves his hat to everybody. And that's how he goes into a damn room. So you can imagine how flamboyant he is other places.
William Price Fox is the author of Satchel Paige's America, published by the University of Alabama Press. He spoke to me from Charleston, South Carolina. Mr. Fox, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. That was a very good interview.
One of the most delightful images in a recently published book of photographs entitled Negro League Baseball shows Satchel Paige in a Kansas City Monarchs uniform. The photograph was taken in the mid-50s at Martin Stadium in Memphis, Tennessee, and Paige is surrounded by five grinning youngsters, aged perhaps 4 to 12. The photographer, Ernest Withers, couldn't be more proud of his subjects.
These were my kids. That's my oldest son, my second son, my third son, my fourth son, my fifth son. But we had two sons born even after that.
Well, I was wondering how you, such a handsome collection of young men had been assembled, but now I understand. They're
they
yours.
Were my children, and I took them to the ball game. Making pitches and making money, we were able to educate 7 boys and 1 girl. They all went to college, and none went to jail, and none were even arrested in a way.
Some of the photographs by Ernest Withers, who was born in Memphis in 1922 and has operated a photographic studio there for more than 50 years, are currently on display at the Hotel Commonwealth in Boston. On Thursday, Mr. Withers and I walked along a row of black and white images, many of them taken at Martin Stadium, which the Memphis Red Sox, a Negro League team, called home. Mr. Withers put a hand on my arm and stopped me at the image of a dozen or so fans, most of them looking directly at the camera.
There's a picture up there. They're real, look like a bunch of cool papas.
Yeah, a bunch of cool papas, as you say, many of them wearing Panama hats, and here the guy in the foreground has a straw boater in his hand. He looks very sharp.
And they were at the Red Sox Park, Martin Stadium, but all of these guys were field streeters, and they were strictly pool room hustlers.
Yeah, and their time off was to come and watch the Memphis Red Sox play.
On Sunday, the pool rooms were closed, and they were there. Their aristocracy of hats made them very noticeable.
Now, in this section of distinguished pool hall hustlers with the two-tone shoes and the Panama and straw hats. You don't suppose any gambling went on at those games, do you?
It wasn't no big gambling like the Pete Rose thing. All black gambling was $2, $3, $1. It was nothing like throwing any ball games in those days.
Many of the photographs record an institution in decline. Though Negro League teams continued to play well beyond the integration of the major leagues in 1947, as the best black ball players found opportunities in the big leagues, interest in the Negro League teams diminished. Some of the teams, most notably one called the Clowns, depended on novelty acts to draw a crowd, hence the photograph featuring Bebop.
The Indianapolis Cincinnati Clowns was owned by Abe Saperstein, who later created the Harlem Globetrotters, and their business was to entertain people at the ball game in baseball uniforms and do some little things that was like baseball, but they were baseball players.
Yeah, because Bebop here stands about what?
That looked to me like about 3'5".
3'5".
Three foot five.
With a baseball bat on his shoulder that stands about 3'8".
And that was at Marden Stadium. Of course, they produced Goose Tatum, King Tut. King Tut and Goose Tatum were the crown prince of clowns. And Goose Tatum was the original crown prince in the Harlem Globetrotters. He was a real baseball player and a real basketball player. He was a clown, but he had great talent. And when they lost a ball game, they were awful mad.
Besides being a documentarian, Ernest Withers is living proof of the way changes in baseball almost 60 years ago provoked changes beyond the game. When I asked Mr. Withers whether he missed Martin Stadium, which was leveled long ago, he shrugged and said no, because he was a good changer.
I lived in the changes of time, in that although I was a photographer, I became one of the first African-American police in Memphis. And during these early days, they didn't have black police. But Jackie Robinson's venture into the major league gave the Memphis Father an opportunity to hire black police, because he felt that if Negro could play baseball, he could be a policeman.
The photographs of Ernest Withers will be on display in the gallery of the Hotel Commonwealth in Boston through May 28th, after which the exhibition will move to Mr. Withers' hometown, Memphis, Tennessee.
Gentlemen, we're gathered here today to honor Satchel Paige and all he gave and all his deeds and all the years he played in the Negro Leagues.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Mark Moran at KJZZ in Phoenix, Peter Levin at Splash Studios in New York, and Bruce Roberts at ARP Studio in Charleston, South Carolina. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view the photographs of Ernest Withers, learn more about Satchel Paige's America, browse Only a Game show archive, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Adam Heisdew's 8-year-old daughter, Alexa.
I like to watch my daddy play, and he does a good job.
Well, that was nice. Thanks for the endorsement.
Watch out, J.P. Ricciardi, Theo Epstein, Billy Bean et al. I hear a really young general manager in training. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
That man at the plate, that man at the plate is none other than Rogers Hornsby. He can hit anything. I've seen him get a single on a throw to third. That ain't the bad news. That man in the on-deck circle, that big man with the skinny legs, Babe Ruth. Folks up here call him the Josh Gibson of the White Leagues. That ain't the bad news. This is the bad news, Satch. We're putting you in.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, From the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.